You're listening to Sustainable Compliance. I'm your host, Jakob Larsen. And what you're going to listen to today is a recording of a webinar that we did a couple of weeks ago on securing buy-in for your processes in the data protection program. There's a PowerPoint that goes with the presentation. And you can find it by going to the show notes.
Hello and good afternoon. Welcome to this webinar on securing buy-in, which is the second webinar in a series of webinars that we do in and around the DPIA process, which my opinion might be probably the most important process or workflow that we have in the data protection department. I'll just try to figure out how to move the slides. I did. So this one webinar is not about the DPIA process itself. If you want to have some insights on that, we did a webinar a couple of weeks ago, and you can go find it at our webinars page on whyablations.com webinars. You can also wait for this one, for this presentation to come to your inbox tomorrow, and you can just follow the link. But one of the things that I have noticed in connection with the DPIA process and other processes is that there is a lot of things going on around it that we also have to have some sort of workings around when we are in data protection. And one of those things is actually being able to sort of influence our surroundings in such a way that they give us the resources that we need, the buy-in to do things, the support, the information, invites us into the processes and so on and so forth. And that is what we're going to talk about today. So I've got two things on the agenda, and it's basically the same thing. So one is how to tailor a plan, how to think about securing buy-in from management for having data protection involved in the process in a very central role. And the other one is how to make sure that the whole organization is aware of the importance of data protection so that everybody will provide us with the things that we need for the DPIA process, which is basically whenever a new system comes into the organization, whenever a new process is being taken on board, we want to be at the table. And the thing is that when I speak to data protection people, every once in a while, or actually often, we're not at that table. So that's what it'll be all about today. I'll tell you a little bit later, I'll tell you a little bit about myself and how I come to this and what I've been doing that I'm tapping into right here. But before we get to it, just give me 90 seconds to tell you who Wyatt Relations is. So basically, we're a software company. We make a solution for DSC. What we've seen is that often in organizations, privacy and information security initiatives are somewhat fragile. When people leave the organization, you have to start over. There's not enough, it's not systematic enough. There's no overview, no control of it. So what we try to do is we try to help turn those sort of fragile privacy initiatives and data protection initiatives into a more sustainable program that can last for more than a cycle of employees. And the way we do that is by basically having all the compliance information that you need collected in one place. So you'll have a mapping of your systems and your vendors, your processing activities. You'll have a yearly cycle of the tasks you've planned. You can see all your data breaches will be in there. You'll have your risks all connected in one system. And now here's the point that goes to what we're talking about today, right? The DPIA process. Because really what you need, I think, to have in a data protection function is that you have to have some good solid workflows where you can, where you if both efficiently and effectively can do your work. And the DPIA process is one of those. And what we support with our solution is basically that you have the information readily available to make the right decisions along the way. So enough about us, because you can always reach out. You can reach out to me or anybody here, and you can see the solution and all that. What it is all about today is securing this buy-in. And what I've created is I've created a seven, what I call seven-step cheat sheet for awareness and buy-in. And this is where I'd like to just tell you a little bit about myself and how I come to this. I've been studying law, like probably many of us in this business. So I come to it from that side. I've also worked in compliance. However, for most of my career, I've worked with politics. I've been in public relations and public affairs. So I've been applying the law somewhat, but most of my career, I've actually tried to convince politicians and others to change the law and to change the regulation so that the businesses and organizations that I work for would have a better way to do business. It would be easier to do business or do whatever we wanted to do that we were funded and stuff like that. So that's basically where I come from. The not so nice term that a lot of people don't like about it is that I've been doing quite a lot of lobbyism in my time. And basically, lobbyism is about convincing somebody else, politician or anybody, to provide you with the resources to change policies so that you can do your job better. And that's what I've been incorporating in this cheat sheet. Is a way of thinking about that I think data protection people could learn from and could take into the way we do things, so that we might have a chance to make our lives just a little bit easier. Because I talk to way too many data protection people who don't feel appreciated, who don't feel that they get the resources necessary, that they don't have the means or hold the sway in their organizations. So it's basically a way of thinking. And one of the things that I'll emphasize here is that I think you should try to apply this systematically. And I think you should also be writing things down, because too often we tend to try to wing it in critical conversations and critical means of communication. I don't think that's necessarily very good. So step number one from the cheat sheet is, what do you really want? And right here, I want to tell you a story. It's not really related to data protection, but I think it's illustrative to data protection. Because one of the things that I've noticed, I've come into data protection, maybe I came into it 7 or 8 years ago. And one of the things that I noticed was that we are a passionate bunch. We talk about human rights. We talk about protecting people, keeping people safe from actual harm. We talk about actually helping democracy, giving people agency, the ability to act on what they want to do and their free will, not being swayed by algorithms and stuff. That's actually what we are talking about. And a lot of us are talking about it very passionately and rightly, because it's super important. And just before I came into data protection, for a long time, I've been very passionate about mental health and mental training, giving people tools to avoid PTSD, depression, stuff like that. And I was with a company, and we were doing this, and we saw that a lot of Danish soldiers came back from war, from zones of conflict, with PTSD, with depression, all sorts of mental health issues. and we thought that was wrong. And we thought that we had some sort of tool for that, that we could train soldiers, not solving it afterwards, not trying to make them better afterwards, but actually giving them something before going abroad that we could help them maybe come back a little bit better, some tools to do that. And so I was, as I said, very passionate about it. And I thought the military should do that. And there were some negotiations with our defense minister and some of the parties in the Danish parliament. So I set up a meeting with this parliamentarian, and I visited him in his office in the parliament. It was just a fantastic conversation. We were talking about how it's wrong that people who go abroad to defend their country or at least solve problems, that they come back with so many problems, PTSD. And so we talked about how preventing it is better than curing it afterwards. And I was just thrilled when I came back, when I came out of it. I was just like, this is good. He was a good guy. And do you know what happened? Absolutely nothing. We had a great conversation, but nothing happened. I never got the military to pay me to train the soldiers to come back better from war and conflict. And I think that talks to the first step, which I forgot even after 25 years in lobbyism. I forgot to do my basic homework. And I think this is something that happens to a lot of data protection and privacy professionals. We need resources to do stuff, and we can have great conversations with the CFO and the CEO and everybody in the organization, and they will agree that data protection and privacy is a basic human right, that we really should protect people, and we can have great conversations. But often I see that nothing really happens. We don't get those extra resources. And I think it has to do with the fact that people don't know what to do after those conversations. People can't just, what do I do now? So they just get on with their job and they never act on what we're doing. The what do you really want part, securing buy-in and awareness and the thing is to actually look very closely at what we really want to achieve in a tangible way. Let's take an example because that's easier. So for the peer process, whenever a new system comes into our organization, whenever there's a new process that we need to address, we need to be invited. So we need an invitation to get into that process. That's often a problem. You all know it. You've had systems being completely integrated into your organization and you never knew about it, but you should have. That's really a thing. So you need an invitation, but you also need resources, right? We need to have just hours to put into assessing stuff, to do deep dives into the vendor, into the system, into the process. We also need competences. We need to have somebody who understands the technical side. We need to have somebody who understands the legal side. We need to have people that actually understand what's going on. So we need resources. And we also need to close a knowledge gap. We need information, basically. We know a lot about data protection, but we don't know what the process is going to do, what is actually happening, what are people actually, what are they doing in all of this? So we need information from the organizations. And fourthly, we need to hold sway. So we need to be able, if I go into a process and I say, we can't do this, we have to do it another way. If I'm not listened to, it doesn't really matter. I might as well just have not been there. So we need some sort of power within the organization. I think we can all agree that if we could get this for Christmas, that would be great. But it's not really, if somebody has to help us, it's not very tangible to do. So the first step is to actually think about what does that look like. So here are some examples. So So these are actual goals. Every time there's a project, someone in the project group must invite data protection. So the first thing we really need is for somebody to put up their hand and go, we should have data protection here. We can just get that far. And if we have that as a goal, we can start approaching those people who actually, in our organization of several hundred people, this might just be five or six people. It's the procurement manager who's always there. It's the project manager in marketing who's in all the processes. All of a sudden, it becomes much more tangible. There are other more tangible things here. Getting 50% of an IT person's time allocated to data protection. Have the CEO talk about our focus on data protection in the media. But this is just basically me trying to illustrate that we have to go from I want some resources and stuff to something that is tangible and that will move us in the right direction. And that was basically what I did wrong in the mental health case that I gave you. I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to get out of it. I had a vague idea that it would be nice if somebody would pay me to do it, but I didn't know exactly how that could be done. And that's actually the second step in this, because we also need to know what the process within our organization is. And when I do that, I always plan backwards. I always plan in reverse. Again, an example. If we want to hire a data protection professional to focus on Adapia, what is the last action that needs to be done to get that? In this case, it's the CFO approves a budget for it. That's basically the last thing in many organizations that needs to be done before we are in complete control of what could be done here. And then just go, so what happens just before that? In this case, it could be that my boss takes it, puts it on the table as one of five priorities that she can have this year. So that might be it. It has to be on that list of five priorities that my boss carries to the budget table. And just before that, I need to convince my boss to decide to have it as a top five priority. I think you get the picture. And here I think it's so important that we think about how the process really is, not how the process should be or how it's in the procedures. I'll give you one last example from my time as a lobbyist, just to show you how different it can be to have the real procedure in your mind. So I was working for this. It was a guy who had invented a pill that could prevent colon cancer, which is a very deadly form of cancer. It was basically a painkiller and B vitamin, but it was probably more, slightly more difficult to do in real life than it sounds. The thing is that if you have to take that over a long period of time, it damages your body. So what he wanted was for the Danish hospitals to screen for colon cancer so that people with the potential to get colon cancer in the near future would be able to get on his pills. And basically, that is something that happens or could happen. You could put money aside for that in the bill of finance, the yearly budget for the government. And in Denmark, that happens in the way that where the government is, they issue, this is what we think should happen with budget. And then there is a reserve to negotiate. So all the parties who are not in government but will be voting in favor of the bill, they have 100 million Danish kroner, half a billion Danish kroner, some sort of money that they can spend on their courses. So we realized you can't go to the Ministry of Finance and get this on the bill. So all we needed was to find a party that would carry this and make it one of their priorities in these negotiations. And we did, and they carried it in. It was like 50 million Danish kroners, not a lot of money, but still we got it done by actually knowing what would have to happen to get it done. And I think very often when we go wrong in these processes, in these, when we communicate and when we try to convince people to act in our favor, maybe we're talking to people who are already in favor, and but we're not talking to those with the power to actually do stuff. So the first step is to get to know actually what is it that you really want and what is the process to do it. The second step is to make an assessment of where we are. What do they, and they here are the people you need to convince, what do they think about this right now? So what is the, in Denmark, we say, we have a saying, I have no idea if you have it in English, but we say that to catch herring, you need to know where it is. So to catch fish, you need to know where the fish is. And this is basically it. It's trying to figure out where the fish is so that we're not fishing in waters without fish. The Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard once pretty famously said that when one really wants to succeed in leading a person to a certain place, one must first of all take care to find him where he is and start there. And I think this is also super important. And it's something that I see in passionate people, especially passionate people who are convinced that they are doing good to the world and we are in data protection. But sometimes we tend to think that if we just say that, if you just convince people that this is the right thing to do, they will actually also do it. And that I think most of you have tried is just not the case. So we need to get out there and get a real sense of what the thinking is on the issue that we're trying to convince people. We have to go talk to people, ask them questions, figure out what is important to them on this issue right now so that we can put together some information that would actually convince them to do what we would like them to do. And again, I can't emphasize enough, I really think you should get a habit of putting pen to paper on these things and actually write down what are your findings? What is it that people think about this? What does the CFO think about having a new data protection professional? How about your own boss? Stuff like that. And really, here it's so important that you don't fool yourself. Some will tend to be very negative, thinking nobody will ever do anything for me. Other people, like myself, will think that everything is much more positive than it is. But really try to get a real sense of where people are and what is important to them when you try to secure their backing. The third step is a little dirty trick. I think it's a bit of a dirty trick. It's figuring out what they, again, the people whom you're talking to, what will they lose by not doing what you think. Back in the 70s, two psychologists figured out that it feels much worse to lose something you have than it feels good to get something you want. It's called loss aversion. And it's something you could really exploit in your favor just by twisting your arguments slightly. I'll show you how. Because it's really just sometimes about reframing the things that you're thinking about putting on the table. And I'll just show you an example. All of us here know that there is a connection between data protection and fraud. At least we are pretty convinced there is. And I think most managements are as well. So it's not something that is just in our heads, I think. So an argument for a new data protection professional might well be that by hiring her, we'll do better data protection, and that will build trust among our customers and lowers risk of data breach. And we'll get more customers. That'll be your argument. And that holds some sway. Some people will react and respond to it, but most people will act much stronger to something like this. So I did a focus group with 10 of our customers. They trust us to protect their information, and that is so good. However, if they lose faith in us, they would do business with, I just called it Ajax Core instead. So we need to invest in keeping that trust. That is an argument that is so much stronger, psychologically so much stronger than the positive one. Just make sure that when you work with your arguments, that maybe you think about what they stand to lose if they don't do what you ask them to do. Step number four is, where can you reach them? I won't go much into this, but basically you should think about how you can reach out to them. When I talk to data protection people, one of the issues that I hear quite a lot is that we don't get enough face-to-face time with management. So we're not necessarily invited on a monthly basis to management meetings. We're absolutely not invited in board meetings. And that means we should find other ways to communicate, or we should make it a priority. Maybe we should make it a goal to actually get into those meetings. So we need to look at the infrastructure of what we do and find ways to reach out to these people. This fall, I was in Brussels, and I heard a very inspiring story from the data chief privacy officer of a big online auction house. And she had decided that she wanted AI to be her thing. And what she did was she didn't have a chance to talk to the board constantly about that. But what she did was that there was a lot of news and information on AI. You probably all remember that. It's still there. And what she did was that she created an internal newsletter on AI that was just going out to management. Nobody else. So it was a newsletter for, I have no idea, probably a lot of people. It was an American company, but still management might be 10, 15, 20 people. And that was because that was her target group. And weekly, she would just give them new information on AI, making sure that they knew that she was the one who knew about AI in their organization. That's a great way to reach out, and I think a creative way to do it. But that's basically something that you should really do. Figure out how can you reach out, other meetings I can attend. Can I go to department meetings, one-on-one meetings, intranet, so on and so forth. Try to be creative. Another hack that I show here is something we use very much in when we did internal communications in bigger organizations. When I was in public relations, very often instead of sending something out through the intranet, which was often something people didn't read, we tried to place stories in the media. So when I was in public relations, those were actual paper newspapers. Now it could be something else, but very often getting your story out in, if it's possible, getting the story about your data protection out into a news outlet or somebody else talking about it is a great It's a great way of showing to your organization that you're there and that you're important and maybe send some issues. And I've had some good stories to tell. Reach out to me. I have the podcast, Sustainable Compliance. So you can come in and we can have a chat about what great things you're doing, and you can send it to management or whoever you need. Those are just a few creative things that I've seen out there. Also, if you run out of ideas, give me a shout. I love to brainstorm on how things can be done in this department. So that was step number four. Step number five. So on your right here, you see a customer quote. It's ours, and it was out on LinkedIn a couple of days ago. Why do you think we do that? We do that because you guys believe us to some extent when we say that what we do is great, but you probably believe your peers even more. You believe people who are not obliged to say anything good about violations in our case, or data protection in your case, you believe them more. So I think one of the tricks that we always use in lobbyism is finding somebody who will do your bidding, somebody who will support you. It could be scientists, it could be politicians who would take our thing on as a cause. In your case, it's figuring out things like who in your organization has the same interests. IT, for instance, would they also like more resources for information security? Could you share a person who could do risk assessments in GDPR and also information security? Maybe outside is this local business council or somebody, are they running a campaign for management to be more aware of privacy that you can tap into? I think one of the things that we underutilize in data protection is talking to the data subjects, basically talking to the people who this is all about, getting their stories and relaying them to people in our organization. I just spoke to data subjects who was subjected to a data breach, and she's so sorry, and this is what has happened, and stuff like that. I think we underutilize that very much. If I could do one thing in data protection that I think would move things so much, it would be that we have a focus group of eight data subjects, and we talk to them monthly, eight new people. Don't want to talk to the same old time, but talking to data subjects, I think we underutilize it because management are rational, but they're also people, and they'll be able to feel with the data subjects and what they think. It's so much easier to empathize with actual people instead of numbers. And that's actually also step number four. Because step number four is that when you communicate in this, when you try to secure buy-in from people, it's so important that you speak both to the mind, the rational arguments, but also that you speak to the guts, just to speak to the feelings. Because whenever you're trying to convince somebody in a business setting, the argument for doing something will probably be rational. They will be resorting to because of this number, because of this cost-benefit analysis. They will be doing that. But the decision in real life might not be that linear. It might not be that rational. It might be prompted by the fact that they feel for somebody who's been involved in something. One of the examples that I often use is that when talking about traffic and trying to convince people to lower speed limits, very often, and I've been involved in this myself, Very often what we'll try to do is tell people, oh, so many people die. And if we just lower the speed limit by 10 kilometers per hour, so much less people will die, but it is just numbers. But when I tell the story about how, like 20 years ago, on my way back from diving up north in Denmark, I was in a car crash in the highway, and somebody hit me from behind at the speed that was a bit over limit, and the after effects. That's what people actually react to. But still, they will also tell you that the reason why they made a decision, that was because of the numbers. But the story will still be there. So I think you should find all the sort of statistical, all the numbers, all of that for your, so all the rational arguments for doing the stuff, that should be absolutely a priority, because that is what will ultimately be quoted when decisions are made. So that's absolutely the first step, finding that type of information. This is just from our system. This is one of the good things about doing data protection systematically, is that you can get some data to show what your risk picture looks like, what kind of resources you're using when you are overwhelmed with tasks, stuff like that. So that should be your first. But then secondly, you should really try to find the stories that could also speak emotionally to management. And again, talk to data subjects, hear what they think, let them tell their story. Also tell stories about what happens when you do stuff. Some of the best and funniest sometimes stories I've heard in this area over the past years are what happens when you send out phishing emails now for testing, and how people react to those. Also, we are in an area where a lot of things happen, and actually a lot of things go into the media. And so you can actually take stories from the news and send it on to management, maybe with a few words attached. That's what the lady from the online auction shop actually did. She just collected news information on artificial intelligence and made her newsletter based on that. So find the information. Again, keep a lot of that information in store, but also try to find the stories that can connect to the gut's feeling. Last thing I want to, I think it's the last thing. No, it's step six. It is. It should probably be step seven. It is to get organized. The thing is, when you're a PR guy, which I used to be and still am to some extent, this is what I do all day. But you also need to do other stuff. I think you should get organized around it. And this is one way I would do it. I would set aside an hour a week to actually get some shit done, so to speak, to set an hour to create just one piece of interaction with management or those people that you're trying to influence, an email about something you saw, a video on your recent awareness training, something that actually, just make something, and so that everything is moving. It's a lot of drips that make a hole in a stone, a lot of drips of water. And so basically, I would do that, set aside an hour a week, and then actually get something out. So that would give at least four interactions a month. And then I'd set aside half a day every month to evaluate the plan and come up with new ideas for nudging and doing things. This could look different, but I think it's important that you don't, first of all, don't go overboard. You should do something, but it can't occupy your entire day. But you could do very much with very little if you do it systematically. So this basically is my cheat sheet. There is seven, isn't there? There is seven. So first, figuring out what you really want and what the process is to get it. where the organization is right now, what people will lose by not doing what you think they should do, where you can reach them, who will support you, speaking to both the mind and the guts, and get organized around it. That's the cheat sheet for me. And you can get this, you will get this by email tomorrow together with the recording of this webinar. If you want to see our system and how it works in this DAPIA process or anything else, reach out to us, book a meeting. We'd love to talk to you about it. Also about how to get organized around this, because there's a lot of resources and time to use efficiently and effectively in some of these workflows and processes. And we just love to talk about that. I mean, both on an organizational level, but also when it comes to solutions and system. And by that, thank you very much. I just check if there are any questions. I can't see any questions. If you have questions, now you can put them in the question section. But if you have questions afterwards, also, if you're thinking about, can I use this argument? What would be a good way to say this or do this? Please do reach out. I love to get some real insights into what you guys are doing out there. So just reach out to me. You can write on the mail that is in here, or you can replace info with Jacob, and I'll see it. I hope you've enjoyed it. One of my goals for the coming years is to make sure that data protection gets more acknowledgement and that data protection get more resources to do what we do. And so I hope you will use this cheat sheet, this way of thinking, to go out and get some more resources and get some more recognition. That's what I'm hoping for. Thank you very much for watching this, and I hope to see you again soon somewhere, maybe online, maybe, which would be nice, in real life. See ya.
You've been listening to Sustainable Compliance. My name is Jacob Larsen, and if you'd like to talk to us, please do reach out. You'll find our contact information on our webpage, wiredrelations.com. We love to hear from the industry, and obviously, if you want to see Wired Relations in action, please do not hesitate to contact us.